Aloha, bitches. What is going on? Happy Sunday. It's your boy, Tall. Matt and I have an incredible guest today. It is my good friend, Billy Kemper. Billy is from Maui, Hawaii, for those of you who don't know where Maui is. It's in Hawaii. He lives in Oahu with his beautiful wife and their children. I would go as far as saying as today is my favorite episode that we've done on Bad News. Billy Kemper is the definition of a true champion, a true friend, a brother, someone that drives you, someone that if you ever need a pickup, he is the man you should call or reach out to. He is one of my favorite humans. He's become such a good friend of mine. His story, ladies and gentlemen, is the story of a true champion. I've watched this kid hit rock bottom and come through with greatness at the end. He saw the light at the end of the tunnel. He had a crazy accident this past year, and I've been watching his road to recovery, and it's been insane. For someone that probably shouldn't be walking or even be alive, this is your guy. This is the guy you want to look up to as a kid growing up. You want to know what action sports is all about? This is your guy. You want to know what a true athlete is? This is the man. You want to know what it's like to be a real dad, someone that drives you? This is your fucking guy. Billy Kemper, I salute you. I'm excited for everyone to listen to this story. Please let us know what you think. Rate this podcast as a 5-star podcast. We got so much more to come, but this is my favorite one so far. Thank you so much.
Hey, yo, bad news. Fuck going on?
Yes. Yep.
Hello, hello, hello.
Wow, you even have headphones? What?
He's professional.
What's happening?
He's professional.
I'm in.
Dude, Billy boy.
Look where I am.
Is that a weight pool?
Yeah.
Are you there?
Yeah, and no one knows I'm here. I'm hiding in an Airstream.
Duh. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So we won't even talk about where you're at. We just, you're on a disclosed location.
No, it's fine. It's just the cast of the reality show can't know I'm here. So I'm like hidden off on the side.
This is a few months out, but even if it, when it comes out, when we bring this out and it's still not out, we won't, we'll just edit it out.
We're all good.
Billy motherfucking Kemper.
Hell yeah.
What's up?
Welcome to Bad News. Finally.
Fuck, I've been waiting to get some bad news in me.
Oh man,
this year has been bad news for all of us.
I've had too much bad news in the last, you know, 4 months. Nothing can be worse.
Have you met Matt yet?
No, I haven't.
This is Matt.
Nice to meet you, boss.
Matt, I hate that I'm meeting you through a fucking phone.
Someday we'll link up.
We should be hungover in Vegas doing this.
Well, yeah, you're... Yeah.
That's like season 4.
Season 4. That and yeah. Billy's about 15 days away from being a year sober, which is crazy to even think about because he's on Tav's level.
Oh, man.
Amazing. Look, I'm wearing fucking the J4WS. Boom. And we'll talk about that in a few. Billy, welcome to Bad News. As some people may know that are listening, Billy is like a little brother to me. He's actually more like an older brother, even though I'm older than he is by like 8 years. So let's get into it. Billy Kemper, where are you from?
Well, first of all, thank you guys for having me on Bad News. It's truly an honor. I'm a huge fan of not only what you've done, Tall, but what you're doing with this platform. It never ceases to amaze me. So I'm psyched. I'm stoked to be a part of it. And yeah, I'm just a little hometown kid from a small neighborhood by the name of Kuau, located on the north shore of Maui, and I now live on the north shore of Oahu.
Wow. So people won't know this. We should kind of break Hawaii down to them. How many islands are in Hawaii?
So I'm basically going to run you through from the northernest island to the southernest, and from the bottom we go. Or I'll start from the south. The most southern island is going to be the Big Island, also known as Hawaii. It's known as the Hawaii Island. And then you have Maui, and there's a few islands that kind of hug Maui, which not too many people know about, Ko'olawe being the first one, which was actually used for military bombing years ago that no humans live on. And then we have Lana'i and Molokai, which are both islands that people live on. And then you go into, we have Oahu, Kauai, and you have a couple small islands, Niihau and Molokini, which there's nobody living on Molokini.
Wow. So when people say the North Shore, like you just said, the North Shore of Maui, do people actually hear that ever? Because all when people hear the North Shore, they think of Oahu.
Exactly.
I just think normal people.
100%. And that's something that I've had to explain. And, you know, when people are like, oh, I'm from the North Shore, they're like, oh, right on. Like, but I'm from the North Shore of Maui as well. But at the same time, you know, we're just a handful of rocks in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, just enjoying the coconut trees sway and some beautiful waves.
Yeah, I'm totally cool with all of that.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
I'd be there right now.
When did you get into surfing, and how did you get into surfing?
I was basically born into it. I had a really beautiful family at my birth. I had two older brothers, one of them being 10 years older than me and basically the forefront of Hawaii professional surfing. At 10 years old, he had beaten every amateur record there was in all events. And that being said, I had a father who was a commercial fisherman, a mom who was sewing bikinis. So my whole family's life oriented around the ocean. There was no like, when am I going to surf? It was just like,
in the water.
There was no ifs, whens, or buts. It was just kind of, and I don't really recall my first time surfing. I was on a surfboard in the water with my brothers and my parents, much way before I could walk.
Yeah.
And I do have some photos of me standing up and surfing around like 2 years old. By myself. That was kind of the beginning. Wow. Is once I could kind of keep my head above the water, I think it was actually before that they strapped on a floaty, but once I could kind of keep my head above the water, they were pushing me in by myself. So
that's crazy
history from there. Yeah.
What I love about Billy is he's like such a fisherman's fisherman, because this dude goes out on like his two to three seater Sea-Doo and like just jumps into the water and goes deep sea diving and just catches his dinner every night, which is like he's cooked for Abby and I. We Abby and I are obviously super close friends with Billy's wife too, and when we go to Hawaii we always go to dinner at their house, and Billy just like cutting the fish he caught that day and just sashimiing us dinner. It's like,
oh man,
fish just melting in your mouth. And now Billy, we'll get to it, but Billy's big time family man. So you have two brothers, they were surfers, you start surfing at age zero. That's amazing. What is like the being a pro surfer, Billy? Like, break it down a little bit. Like, obviously, when you're young, you're not like, I'm gonna be a pro surfer, or maybe you are, right? And you're like, that's the dream. Like, what motivates a kid from Hawaii to become, a pro surfer? Like, what do you dedicate every morning to, like, waking up before becoming pro?
I think like, just being from Hawaii, and for me, it was my brother. My brother was like, I feel like most younger siblings, it just depends on the connection, but a lot of the times they look up to their older brother. And for me, my brothers weren't like a 3-year difference from me. They were my next youngest brother, Eric, who is a surfer, who's 10 years older than me. The other brother I have above him is my brother Carl, who's 12 years older than me. So they were like my idols. As much as they were my brothers, there was no competition because of the age difference. There was nothing I had to fight them for. It was more just like, they loved me. I was their baby brother. And how much I admired my brother Eric was crazy. He traveled a lot starting at a young age, and I just wanted to be him. He was so cool to me. Everyone loved him. Everyone wanted to hang out with him at the beach. And I just thought that was, I thought being a surfer was going to make me like him. And that's kind of what started the whole process. And I'll be the first person to admit it. My childhood in my surfing results as an amateur were far from perfect. I definitely was not in the spotlight. I wasn't the kid who had the Hurley or Billabong or Quicksilver sticker on the nose of their board at a young age. I didn't have the financial backing and the contracts and the coaches and all that shit. It was just doing it because I loved it and doing it because my brother did it and I wanted to be like him. And for me, there was my childhood, there was no schedule. It was, if I went to school, great. If I didn't, I better be surfing or doing something in the ocean. And that's kind of where I feel like I separated myself from a lot of other people, where just because the waves were bad didn't mean that I wasn't going to be in the ocean. My dad was a commercial fisherman. Both my brothers loved fishing and spearfishing. And it kind of just turned the ocean into my playground, where it wasn't like, I see a lot of the new generation and the up and coming surfers. It's like they show up at the beach and the waves are flat. The waves are shitty. They're like, oh, we're out of here. We're going to go home. Where for me, I'm like, oh, sick. It's a perfect day to go diving. Let's grab the dive gear. It's a perfect day to go fishing. Let's grab the fishing gear. You know, there's always something to do in the ocean. And that's kind of what raised me, was just using the ocean for different ways of having fun, but also being able to provide food, provide fun, just so many different aspects of it. And that was kind of, there was no real routine. And I think most people who looked at me probably didn't think of me to be the next big pro surfer or to really succeed in it. It was, oh, he surfs good and he loves it and he's crazy, but by no means is he up to par with some of the other guys who are in the spotlight during my time at that age. So yeah, it was kind of just, you know, the more time you spend in the ocean, the more comfortable you get is kind of how I look at it.
At what age do you think things started to shift for you from amateur to pro? Like when you started noticing your style is changing, you're becoming a different human. Obviously your entire squad, they're obviously big names as well. Obviously from the Rothman family, Coa Smith, just like all of your friends, the list is pretty large. And I feel like you guys inspire each other to get better. But at what age do you think you started noticing like a crazy shift?
Man, it really honestly didn't come till late. Obviously, like I had the mindset and I knew what I wanted at a young age. It just, things weren't falling into place the way I had visioned them to. Because I was competing at the highest level, like on the biggest stages at a real young age, at, you know, 13, 14, all the way up until I was 17, till I graduated high school, at the NSSA Nationals down at Lowers with guys like Kolohe and Dino, Coco Ho, John Florence, Carissa Moore. I mean, there's world champions in that four that I just gave you. And I was competing with them and against them. And it was difficult for me. I think a lot to do with it was most of the competition that I was surfing in the amateurs was smaller, like more mushier, like playful waves, as I would say, compared to what I grew up surfing in. Hawaii is known to be a lot larger and heavy water, a lot scarier. And I think that's what kind of separated me. It really like drew my attention of like, this is what I want to do. And I don't care if I lose to these guys in these small events or all I care about is what's over here. And I won a contest at Sunset, the XL Pro, when I was 20 years old and I had partied for like 3 nights before it, like straight, just careless, no fucks given, just like
full throttle,
no holding back, just completely had no responsibilities, had no job, was living with my mom on the North Shore, doing things that people would never imagine to make money and to get by. And that led into just like winning a event at that scale and beating like guys like Makua, beating guys like Coa Smith, like John, the list went on. I was like, it kind of hit just like a different area. Like, holy shit, like I can beat these guys. And the waves weren't massive, but you know, Sunset Beach is somewhere that I grew up surfing on the North Shore. And that year, 2010, it was actually a week after Andy Irons had passed away. Mm-hmm. I just hit this switch that I wasn't going to give up. And I was like, you know, at 20 years old, if you're not signed to a big company making six figures at my day and age, like when at that point, it was like, yeah, he's probably not going to make it. And I didn't even have a sponsor at this point. I mean, little sponsors, but by no means was anyone paying my bills and mortgage and supporting a family. And I connected with my trainer now, Kahea Hart, who's a longtime family friend, and he kind of just got me out of trouble and set me on the right track and introduced me to fitness and training and showed me the ins and outs of how it is to work hard and what it takes to work hard and overcome, you know, big battles in life. And that was it, man. 20, it went on. When I was 21, I met my wife now, Tahiti, and since I started dating her, she seen where I was headed and she seen the people I was hanging out with and what I was doing. And she knew it was temporary and that, you know, everyone needs to have a good time. Everyone needs to enjoy themselves, but it wasn't a lifestyle that you could live forever. And that's the bottom line. It's like,
Billy was having heart attacks at airports.
Oh man.
Let's just say you gotta truly live.
You lived, and of course
I was living and I was enjoying myself and I felt like I was a rock star, but I hadn't made it yet.
Right.
Is that kind of like the surfer culture in a sense though? Like, does everyone
somewhat kind of like- I think I was maybe on a little level ahead. You know, I was going to Vegas like every other weekend with, you know.
Oh, with this guy and shit. Yeah, I can only imagine.
Of with people who I
would tap out. How about that?
To be honest with you, I was going to Vegas with people who are now in jail for, one of my best friends got 18 years in conspiracy. So it's like, I was with the wrong group of people. The wrong group of people. I was just surrounding myself in the wrong element at the wrong time. And
they weren't, and they weren't growing up.
No. And they didn't have a vision I had. And my wife seen that, and she was dating me when I had no income, when I was like, we're splitting meals and shit. Like, it, I look at it now and I'm just like, I'll never let you pay for a single thing for the rest of your life, I promise you.
Yeah.
And that all kind of changed, you know, and then you just kind of fast forward time and then poof, a kid on the way. And that is when everything just like
changed.
I went from like going from like first gear to second gear to just hitting fifth gear wide open. It was just like, I had no time. It was just kind of an all or nothing situation on getting my shit together and truly making a living to start providing.
Crazy. We haven't even like started. And Billy is like,
I'm taking off already.
Fuck. Billy.
I know, I'm going to stop myself before I keep going.
You talk a lot about manifest stuff. Like, you manifest a lot of things. You visualize a lot of things. You say that. What does that mean to you? Like, you say that in interviews, you say that, you know, on your posts on social media, you know, how do you see things now?
It's hard. And I think as you know me on a really personal level, I've went through quite a few battles in my life, whether they've been family loss, loss of friends, just or injury, you know, there's so many different scenarios in life. And it's been something for me to just really overcome those times of visualizing positivity and finding a way to put all that negative attitude and energy in towards working back towards positivity. And that's been like something to me that saved my life. And by no means has my motivation or inspiration come from people in my sport. Yeah, it has here and there, but you know, for me, I look at guys like Kobe Bryant, guys like Conor McGregor, people who straight up visualize things so well that they just made it happen. They believe they did it so much over and over. They practiced it so much continuously that mentally it already happened. And so once they stepped into that position that they had to compete in or fight in or just, you know, walk a line in, it was already done. All the hard work was done, and now it was time to enjoy yourself. And that's kind of how I've lived my life and how I've figured out how to really visualize and manifest things. It's like, you know, there's no more days of me wishing and wanting. It's truly like, if this is what's on my radar, I'm gonna get it, and it's just a matter of time. And I don't like to show my true colors until I'm 100% confident that I'm ready. I'm not somebody who likes to compete at 50% or kind of go out and, yeah, give it a half-assed job. Like, if I'm out there and people are watching, like, I want to be confident that I can beat anyone and that I feel the best that I can feel.
Love it. break down somewhere like Sunset to me real quick compared to Jaws, because I don't think people understand like the difference between those two waves, right? Let's just two spots in Hawaii. One's in Oahu and one's in Maui. What's the difference between the two waves?
Sunset Beach is probably one of the most famous surf breaks in the entire world. It's a monumental wave. It's an unbelievable. And one of the challenges of Sunset, it's such a big playing field. And, you know, you look at a wave like Trestles or, you know, Pipeline. You see the surfers that are so tight. The crowd is so condensed because the reef and where the wave breaks, it's such a tight area. And Sunset's the opposite of that. It's a huge playing field. There's certain high spots of the reef of where the wave breaks, and it can all change. And I mean, Sunset Beach is a wave that's probably best at from, I'd say, like, you know, 4 to 5 foot faces to about 25 foot faces. That's kind of its premier range. And about 15 to 20 foot face waves are probably when it's at its best. People think of it as a big wave, which it is. It's violent. It's scary. There's lots of current. And it's one of the hardest waves in the world to learn. And when I explain learning a wave, it's kind of just getting an understanding on where the wave is going to break, where the currents are, where's the safe spots, where's the danger spots. And then you want to compare it or see the difference between that and a wave like Jaws. Basically, Jaws, what you would do is you would insert Sunset Beach with some steroids and pump it up about 6 to 8 times. So you take that 10 foot, you know, 10 to 20 foot scale at Sunset, and we're going to bump that up to like a 60 to 80 foot scale. It's the pinnacle of big wave surfing. There's no wave in the world that you can compare it to. And it's honestly the one wave that the bigger it gets, the better it gets. And yeah, it's those two waves they're really special to me. I've had obviously majority of my success and my biggest wins at both those venues. So it's, I hold a really special place for those spots in my heart.
That's amazing. When you talk, can you break down also, like when you say like 4 foot face, 10 foot face, I just want kids to like learn, you know, so they understand. Cause they don't get
the
it.
The next time a kid's standing at a building and you're thinking, okay, one story, two story, three story, basically every story you look at, I'm looking at as like a, you know, one story to me is kind of like between a 8 and 10 foot faced wave. So go up, hit the 8th floor at the Palms or the Red Rock and look down. And that's kind of what I'm dropping into.
Yeah, no, that's the videos of you are every time I see you on TV, I just want to hurl, because you're seeing Billy and you're just seeing the board. Oh, just yeah. Like,
and then the craziest thing is, so when you said learn, like, does someone like, is there like, do you have to read articles, you go on the internet, or do you like learn by being in the water over and over and over and
that's
over?
Your learning.
That's the learning, right?
And by the way, it's all rocks underneath you. It's not like it's soft sand.
No, by no means. I mean, yeah, there's waves of sand, but where I come from in Hawaii, you know, those are all old volcanoes. So it's all, we're surfing over all lava rock and coral reefs. So by no means do you want to fall. And the learning stages of surfing, it's not about reading or studying. I mean, it's truly about just putting in time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you don't just paddle out to Jaws when it's 60 to 80 foot if you've only surfed, you know, in California your whole life. There's levels to it.
He's got even breathing requirements. Like, oh,
yeah.
Even trained breath out.
Yeah, let's talk about that real quick. Like, what's a workout for you, Billy? Like, let's say you're getting ready for the tour. And what is waking up for Billy? Just so we're clear, Billy wakes up at like 4 or 5 in the morning every day and does like 100 workouts. But I want people to know, because I think a lot of people see surfing as like you're going longboarding, or it's like little mini waves, where this guy is literally surfing waves the size of buildings.
Yeah. You know,
and he gets sucked underneath for a while. And we'll get into some of his injuries in a second. But I want people to know like how prepared you have to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. So right now, I'm in California right now, and that due to being from an injury, which we'll probably get into. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, what's crazy is right now is that I haven't even really surfed yet since I've been injured. and I'm training right now as if I'm, if I have a world title next week, like if I'm literally up for a world title. And it's not to compete, it's just to get my body back. But as far as like taking my, my days and fitness serious, it's probably as serious as it's ever been right now. And kind of my day to day right now, when I'm here in California away from my family, it's, I wake up bright and early. I drink a huge cup of Laird superfood coffee with a bunch of fats in it, and that's kind of my go-to in the mornings. And then from there I start with about, it really depends, but basically a minimum of like 30 minutes of foundation training. It's like body alignment and just keeps my posture really well, stretches out my spine. And from there I go into working my diaphragm, of doing some breath work and starting to expand my lungs. I, part of my injury was that I collapsed my right lung. And aside from that injury, the breath work that I've been doing the last few years of my life is, as much as, you know, you need to train and be strong, being able to control your heart rate for what I do is probably the hardest thing in the game. And that's been a huge part of my formula over the last couple of years. And Laird Hamilton had partnered with Wim Hof and basically took this Wim Hof breathing exercises and scenarios and transformed it into performance, into athletes, and being able to, you know, control your heart rate, being able to have your blood filled with oxygen, just the all different scenarios. So for me, it goes from foundation training into about 30 minutes of XPT breath work. And there I jump in my car and I drive up to Malibu to the Hamilton compound, and I do about 2 hours of pool training. And this is underwater training with really heavy weights. And this is all done with Laird and his crew up there. And for anyone who's interested or has more questions about it, they can, if you have Instagram, check out the XPT Instagram or Laird Hamilton.
Oh yeah, definitely,
you
can Google Laird Hamilton.
Yeah. 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 Google Laird Hamilton or XPT. And you'll just be blown away on the shit that we're doing. You know, we're doing, you know, squat jumps with 260-pound dumbbells in the deep end of the pool just to get your mouth out of the water to take a breath. And you do 100 jumps without stopping, like stuff like that. And that's where your heart rate's going crazy, but you have to control yourself because you're under stress and you only get one breath per 10 seconds. And there's different, you know, scenarios that we use and protocols, but that's basically my first real workout. And we normally end that with some contrast of heat and ice, which is, I mean, Laird's on a different level. He's running his sauna at like 240 degrees up to like 250. Like Joe Rogan.
Yeah, I heard was, from the Rogan. He was like melting Rogan, his thermometer.
No, yeah. He was texting him the other day when I was with Laird, and he was like, Laird, I got mine up to 220 and it's too hot. Like, this can't be good for you. And Laird sent him a picture back when we were in it, and it was at 255. And it was like, your sauna's not hot enough. So from there,
your sauna's not hot enough.
Yeah. From there, doing a few rounds of the sauna on ice, I get a quick smoothie and I head up to the Sports Academy, which was also known as the Mamba Academy, where Kobe created that training facility. And I've been doing a lot of my strength and conditioning and physical therapy up there. I do a couple hours there with a really amazing team. And then I drive down to Irvine. And when I get to Irvine, and not to mention this Mamba facility is in Thousand Oaks, north of LA. So from there, I drive down about an hour and a half, try to beat traffic down to Irvine. And I work out at the Medterra W training facility with a guy named Joe there, Joe and Johnny. And that's kind of like a all full body workout, just kind of to stay consistent and kind of not think about my therapy and my injury, and just kind of do a full body workout. And when I'm done with that, I head down to Dr. G in Costa Mesa and do about 2 hours of straight tissue work and scar tissue manipulation on my knee and hip. So it's a pretty busy day. You know, there's quite a few training sessions, and it's a lot, and people always ask why so much. And for me, you know, when I get on that flight, when I leave Hawaii, there's nothing I have to worry about in my days aside from my body and healing myself as fast as possible. I don't have crying kids. I don't have my wife telling me what to do at home, you know, and I do feel selfish for having that much time on my own. And that being said, you know, it's more so not only to do it for myself, but to make sure that I'm doing it for my family and they have a good grip and understanding on why I'm here. You know, when I come home after 2 weeks of that 6 days a week, 4 to 5 training sessions a day, and my wife and my kids see my progress of the difference of me, you know, not being able to walk upstairs to running upstairs to jumping to, you know, hopefully surfing after this trip, it gives them a lot of positivity. It brings, I think, a lot of warmth to their heart, knowing that I'm working really hard and that I'm not bullshitting. Like I'm taking this really, really serious.
Amazing. Yeah. We might as well just get into the injury. Since I've known you, I think you've had 2 major injuries, this one being the worst. Let's rewind you leaving Hawaii and going on this trip with some friends that I think you had a bad feeling on from the minute you left Hawaii. Where were you going?
So the North Shore winter season basically wraps up on February 10th. That's the last event in Hawaii. I came off the biggest heater of my career. You know, it doesn't happen often in surfing, especially because of, you know, our platform to perform on is Mother Nature. It's never consistent. It always changes. It's not like a skate ramp, you know, where you can practice something over and over and over. And that being said, you know, being consistent in going on a roll in surfing it's next to impossible. And this year I did something that I might've told you last year was impossible. I overcame some huge obstacles. I won some events and I rode some waves that were once probably looked at not rideable. And that being said, I just had this this roll of momentum and just confidence that I could kind of overcome and do anything I wanted. And right out of the floodgates of the North Shore season ending, I mean, when people look at newspapers in the morning, I look at basically a map of the entire world, and it's just colors of blobs moving, and those blobs are storms that create swells. And during the ending of winter, the North Shore in Hawaii, the Pacific Ocean starts to slow down, but the Atlantic Ocean, the Indian Ocean, there's certain areas that are still firing away with big storms. And this storm I seen off of the coast of Northern Africa was much bigger than anything I've ever seen there. And this is, I've been in South Africa a handful of times, but never Northern Africa. And this was my first, you know, real glimpse at, am I going to go down there? And I made a call to a good friend, Jerome, down there, who kind of runs the show. And he's like, hey, this looks like 10 days of swell that I've possibly never seen here. So I rang a couple friends, Koa Smith and Luke Davis, and snap your fingers. And we were traveling around 40 hours across the world to show up and surf the day we landed. So we flew across the world, got there, it flew straight into pumping waves. I extended my trip twice. And the last day of the trip was, you know, aside from the injury, still I'll probably live the rest of my life and tell you that was probably the top 3 best days of surfing I've ever had.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really special. It was, you know, to be able to surf waves with no one around, like
that's the dream.
Unheard of. Yeah. And especially with your friends to be like high fiving, you know, surfing Pipeline is a dogfight. Surfing a lot of the waves I surf around the world, it's like, you know, you got to fight for what you get. Like it's really hard, and it's a different side of the sport to where this, when I'm being sent off somewhere on a trip to basically create content, to go film, to get a bunch of, you know, photos for all my sponsors, to basically fill up on content, to have a bucket full of stuff basically to put out and produce throughout the summer, is it's a different mindset and mentality going on one of these trips, especially when I had 2 of my best friends and we're going to a new location and the waves lived beyond of what our hopes were for. And yeah, that saying when, you know, you kind of say never, or never say like one more try. I was in the water for about 9.5 hours and I just kind of told myself, like, I want to get one more. Like, I want to get one crazy wave, one more. And that crazy wave came in, and by no means was this wave anything out of my element or different than what I've surfed. It was probably, you know, I've fallen on waves 3, 4, 5 times the caliber and
right.
and strength of this thing. I just fell in the wrong place at the wrong time. And, you know, the force of Mother Nature drove me into a rock on the right side of my body, which knocked me out cold. And I collapsed my right lung. I broke my pelvis in half. And I tore my quad muscle down the middle. And then I basically completely destroyed my knee. I tore my ACL in half off the bone, MCL and meniscus completely in half as well. So as far as an athlete injury, it was kind of like
a career killer.
Yeah, the career's done.
And this happens all underwater
from like I hit a rock. So basically, I mean, you know, a wave, it breaks like this, and yeah. I can send you guys a video to where you guys can show people. I fell inside of the barrel in the hollow part of the wave, which is kind of the goal of surfing, is being in the barrel. And I went over with the lip of the wave, and the lip of the wave drove me into a rock. And with all that water, like, you know, it's basically like having a big pool, like you in a pool being lifted up into the,
yeah.
like, you know, 50 feet above a concrete surface and just dumping, you know, a hotel pool upside down. And that drove me into that rock, and it knocked me out cold, and I surfaced due to having some flotation on me, and a jet ski came in and rescued me. And that kind of started that was basically where shit hit the fan.
So from there, Billy, where did they take you? Cause they were moving you around for a second.
Yeah.
What's the story from
North Africa?
Well, the story is pretty crazy.
Yeah, man. I was taken into this harbor, not to mention like, Morocco is beautiful. There's yeah. some amazing places. There's beautiful hotels. There's beautiful restaurants. Where we were surfing is up in like this, I don't even know how to explain. I mean, it's up in the desert, but there's like industrial, like chemical being like an industrial chemical, like area where it's like, they're making all these chemicals up there, and there's not really much around. It's a lot of desert and just, yeah, it's really isolated up there. And I was put in an ambulance and taken to a hospital about 10 minutes away. And I'm freezing cold. At this point, it's basically dark. I'm in my wetsuit still. I can't move. I have no idea what's happened. I kind of thought that, in my mind, I thought that I pulled my hip out of the socket and I broke my femur, and I didn't know. I knew my knee was destroyed, and I couldn't tell if I was paralyzed or what, because I couldn't move my toes. I had no real feeling or movement in my right leg. And I was taken into this hospital, and this first hospital was like, I mean, if you go on Google right now and you just Google in like, horror movie hospital, probably gonna fall under that.
Oh my god,
there was like a lady giving birth on the floor when I walked in, and there's no windows, there was nobody in uniform, there was no rooms, there was no hospital beds, there was nothing. I was on a stretcher from that ambulance. I was put onto like a table with wheels, and they were like holding me so I didn't fall over. It was that, honestly, like, really, to put a lot of this into perspective, that moment right there really kind of like, it turned into a survival scenario of like, fuck, am I going to live? Because I didn't know what was next. I didn't know where we're going from there, what my body was going to do. And they took me in, people are yelling, freaking out. And my buddy Cole Smith was there with me, and I never let go of his hand the whole time. I'm like, I don't care where they're taking me, you're not leaving me. Not like, that's the bottom line. And, you know, our brotherhood and our bond that we have when we travel across the world like this, it's endless. And that's kind of the bottom line, is like, you know, we're there for each other till the end. And we, from there, they took me into this little, I don't even know what it was, of a room, and this old x-ray machine. They tried to get an x-ray of me, took me back out into this big open area with people. There's blood and just like disgusting area. They bring out this image and they're holding it up to like a light bulb. Somebody's got a cell phone light like this, like looking at the image, and it just looks completely blurry. But you could see that my hip was in its socket and that my femur was intact, but you could see like this little lightning bolt through my pelvis, but it was so blurry. And that was like the first indication that I had broke my pelvis, and that's where the pain was coming from. And from a medical standpoint, breaking your pelvis is it's pretty scary. It's pretty easy to bleed out from. And there, depending on the break, it can be an immediate surgery, like an emergency, or it can't be. And from there, obviously that hospital was not where I was going to stay. They got me a legit ambulance, threw me in the good ambulance, and we were off to a 3.5-hour drive and down into the main city of Casablanca, where they put me in one of the nicer hospitals, which, you know, to this day, I look at that hospital as like probably worse than the absolute worst hospital in the state of Hawaii. Like, even still, you know, it was a nightmare. That whole mission, you know, 4 or 5 days there seemed like months,
2 years,
you know?
Yeah. Because you also like, couldn't breathe, right, Billy? You had problems breathing, and you were like trying to explain to them what to do, and they said, well, we don't do that here.
Yeah, I had water in my lungs, and people who are familiar with drowning, you know, people with the lifeguard background, there's something called secondary drowning, and that's where your lungs are filled with water, and it's where a lot of people, where a kid will drown at a pool or he'll drown at the beach, and they pull him out, they perform CPR, and they take him home, and he's fine. 2 or 3 days later, he dies in his sleep. Why? Because there's water in his lungs, and that water creates pneumonia, and you basically drowned in your sleep without that water being extracted. Where in Hawaii, the amount of drownings are so consistent. Places like Hawaii, Australia, where there's lots of waves, lots of tourism. When you drown, you're taken into the ER. They look at your lungs. They check out how much water's in. They'll put a scope through your ribs. They'll put you under anesthesia and put a vacuum or something down through your throat into your lungs and vacuum it all out there to clear it out. And basically in Africa, or where I was in Morocco, they said they don't do that in their country. And my doctors and my people back in the US were starting to get really irritated. Like, it was to the point where it was basically my doctors telling these doctors down there, like, hey, you're going to let this kid who's a father and a husband die in front of your own eyes if you don't take care of him. And this was all in the middle of trying to organize me getting medevaced out of the country. I wasn't eligible to fly like commercial business, none of that. I couldn't, for me, with the broken pelvis where I was at and the way I was bleeding out, was I needed to be strapped to a table, and I could basically bring my upper body to about like a 30-degree angle, and I couldn't cough. I couldn't sneeze because of the pressure opening up the break in my pelvis. So I couldn't cough up any of this water. And it honestly, day two, day three, my lungs started to sound like a bong, like bubbling.
Yeah.
Like literally every breath, it sounded like I was taking like a hit out of a bong. Like it was crazy, man. It was bubbling. And I went into secondary drowning on my third night. And this is after like 2 days of not a single calorie intake of like, you know, I was straight up like shitting and puking myself on a hospital bed. They couldn't even lift me up to put a fucking diaper on me. Like it was a horror story, man. It was fucking radical. Nurses laughing at me, not helping me. Like it was honestly as bad as it gets. And you know, after the secondary drowning, I was taken into the ICU and put on breath support. And at that point, like my doctors and the WSL, they're just like, all right, enough is enough. This kid's going to die. And they organized a private plane to come in that night at like 3 a.m., got me onto the plane, and the mission started from there. I was really fortunate to have Koa Smith, one of my best friends, stay back with me and help basically escort me back home. And we went from, because of where my lungs were at and how bad my breathing was, we had to stop consecutively. So we went from Morocco to Bordeaux, France, from Bordeaux, Greenland, Canada. We get to Canada. Not to mention, this is the last week of February when COVID-19 is just absolutely breaking through the roof of everywhere.
Playing it back in America, and that's why they actually went that way.
Oh, okay.
So I get to Canada, LAX Customs says I can't enter because I'm coming from Europe, and I'm just like, what the fuck? What's going to happen now? Okay, they call San Bernardino. Nope, shut down. They call Long Beach. Oh, there's no customs there. There's no international. Nope, shut down. And luckily enough, you know, I know some people. We made some phone calls, and Van Nuys cleared me to come in. I landed in Van Nuys, and the second I landed there, I was put in the ambulance, and I was taken down to a hospital down in Los Angeles. And I met my family there and my two youngest sons, Hayes and Lion, my brother Carl, and my wife Tahiti. And honestly, the second that I kind of seen them, I felt like I felt like everything was over, even though like I hadn't even been through one surgery yet. I'm still strapped to a bed. Like the feeling of having to survive and fight for your life, that was all out the window. Like I truly felt like I had overcome the biggest hurdle in my life. And it was a big relief to see my family. And that goes back to like what and who motivates me. It's like at the end of the day, you know, I can tell you that all these different athletes and all these world champions have motivated me and inspired me. But at the end of every single day and the start to every single morning, there's one thing that gets me going more than anything, and that's my family. And that's what I fought for, and that's who I'm here for. And that was the beginning of the end of the first chapter of this injury.
Yeah. I mean, I talk to you a lot, you know, not every day, but we talk enough where I know how hard you've been working to make the comeback. And I've met you at Laird's house. You know, I've seen what you do. You FaceTime me with Dr. G. Let's talk real quick about, just so people know how good Billy really is. I wear this hat. I've been wearing this hat for the last few months. You know, it's funny. I was with my boss the other day and he had some serious people with him. And they're like, oh, what's that hat? And I was like, oh, it's one of my dearest friends. You know, it's they're like, what's J4WS? I'm like, well, Jaws is a big wave in Hawaii. And I believe my friend, you know, won this competition, this contest 4 times. Let's talk about this hat, Billy. Like what does this hat mean? So I can start explaining it to the people correctly.
Let's just say that next year you'll have the same hat and that S will be a 5.
Fuck yes. Boom.
No. Like I said, you know, back to the beginning of Jaws being a very special place for me. That was not my introduction. Obviously, you don't just go straight into Jaws, but that's what changed my aspect as a professional surfer and my vision of what I wanted to do. I was one of the younger kids to kind of ever surf out there. I think I was like 14 or 15 the first time I surfed out there. It wasn't 80 feet. It was probably like, you know, 30 to 40 foot. And I just knew that this is what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And at the beginning stages, it was tow and surfing, which is behind like a wave runner, a jet ski, whatever you guys want to call it, holding on to a rope similar to a wakeboarder does, going 50 miles an hour with feet strapped into a tiny board, letting go. And it makes it really easy and fun. And that's what I was doing. And fast forward some years later, they announced the first ever paddle in surfing contest out at Jaws. You know, 10 years ago, paddle surfing at Jaws was not possible.
It's impossible.
In the eyes of the surf world, in the eyes of myself and pro surfers, we're like, fuck, that's not possible. And when they released that event, it was like, holy shit.
Right.
Like, this is going to be the biggest event in surfing. It's a Super Bowl of surfing. And being from Maui, being one of the upcoming and local kids from there, they gave me a wild card into this event because this event was on the World Tour, which is the top 24 big wave surfers in the world, who I was not a part of at the time. And this is in 2015. That horn blew that morning for the first heat, and I was in it, and I just kind of fell right into place. I just felt so comfortable, and it was like I knew that morning that I was going to win that event, and it put me on the map. It jumped me because of the level. So the Big Wave World Tour, the way it works is events can be rated depending on the size and quality of the wave. And it starts with bronze, silver, gold. And it's very rare that the tour had gold events. The majority of them were bronze and somewhat silver. And the gold event is double the points of any other event. I won that event that day and jumped into number one on the world. And they told me that I couldn't compete in the other events because I wasn't on tour. But I was like, but I'm winning the world title off of one event. And there's one event left. That being said, they didn't let me compete in the whole tour that year, but I ended up being second on the world tour at the end of the year with only surfing one event, which threw me right into the big leagues with the best big wave surfers in the world. And I won that same event the next year in a row. And it was so special for me to win it a second time because I felt like people might have thought it was maybe luck or, luck or like, yeah, you know, oh, wow, man, he got lucky or this and that. And I was like, no, this is my wave. I'm going to win this event a lot. Like,
it's the second year where your board kind of skipped, Billy, where you kind of like, you know what I mean? You kind of like dropped in and it was like you were in the air almost and then went into the wave.
Yeah. So I've had a couple of those out there because that, not to mention where Jaws is the northern shore of Maui is the windsurf capital of the world. It's the windiest place consistently, I think, worldwide. So to mix match that with a 60-foot swell moving across the ocean, having, you know, luckily we've had, you can't paddle it when the winds are anywhere over 25 miles an hour. It just, you put 50, a wave that's moving at 30 to 40 miles an hour with a 30-mile-an-hour gust, you're getting 80-mile-an-hour wind on the face of that wave. It's just not possible to get down with your own two arms. So, yeah, I won that event the second year in a row, and I won it, like, really well. I won with a total of, like, 19.5 points. I had a perfect 10, which is really rare, a 10 and a 9. And, like, I made it a really clear statement that I was –
here to stay. That,
yeah, exactly. And then – The following year, I got second to Ian Walsh, who is kind of like a mentor, older brother to me. I got really hurt in the first heat of that event. I'm not really hurt. I had a small tear in my MCL, my left knee, and I messed up my quads really bad, and I couldn't really walk. I had what's the shots? The cortisone shot. That night, because it was split up into 2 days, and the next day, the final day of the event, I ended up getting second place, and that second place was worse than any result I've ever had in my entire life. I felt like
you're robbed.
I felt like my wife left me. Like, yeah. I was like lost for words, and I was really quiet about it, as far as like how I spoke upon, but as far as how I went about it was totally different. Every morning I woke up thinking about giving second place. And what I mean by second place, I mean last. Like, I just continuously told me I am the worst surfer out there and I have to be the best. And I came back the next year and I won it. And there was no way I was going to get second. And there was a little bit of controversy on the internet that I maybe should have gotten second place. And that really pissed me off again. So this year I came back and I was like, no, the hammer is going to be dropped again. And I won it for my, yeah. So year five, I came back and I definitely put the stamp on the envelope and sent it off with a good explanation of, you know, this being the event that I am going to win for sure. And yeah, you know, it's like this event's ran 5 years and I've got four wins and one second place. And I think as far as in my industry and in my sport, there's probably never been anything like that. And I'm definitely not cocky in what I do. I'm really humble, but I'm very confident at the same time. You know, I predict what I want and that's kind of how I live my life. And when people second guess me or like, you know, kind of talk down on me, it's like, you know, you don't know what I've went through. You don't know the deck of cards that I've been dealt with. You don't know that I have two stepchildren and two real children and a wife who lost her mother the same way, you know, I lost my mom. My dad abandoned me. My mom, my wife's dad, he's there, but he doesn't live in Hawaii. And, you know, we're we're a family of six, and we don't have help or support outside from, you know, we have
you're survivors, man.
Yeah, we're survivors, but at the same time, we're providers and, yeah, and we're warriors. We've worked really hard, and my wife has showed me how to do that too, you know, and that's where a lot of this success and drive comes from. And I'm very passionate about what I do, and I've whether I'm competing at Sunset Beach, Pipeline, or Jaws, I'm definitely there to win. And that this year's Jaws event came from like in the middle of probably the biggest spotlight I had ever been under. I had competed the day before that event at Pipeline during the biggest world title race in the history of surfing against the number one guy, who's Italo Ferreira, on probably the biggest stage in surfing at Jaws. I mean, at Pipeline during the Pipe Masters. I think there's more views that day online than any other day in surfing history. And I beat Italo, who's number one on like the CT, which is a championship tour. It's different than the big wave tour. And I beat him pretty damn well. And that kind of just built the momentum of me going, jumping on a flight that evening to Maui and competing the next morning. So it was a busy winter, and kind of just a little rundown of, you know, my career in as short as possible ways. There's been a lot of other big results, but as far as my name and where people probably, where I get recognized most is definitely at Jaws.
That's why I brought it. I mean, we could sit here for hours to talk about waves all around the world, but Jaws, I know what Jaws means to you, and I wanted people to know about Jaws. If people want to see Billy surf, you could YouTube him. There's definitely plenty of waves out there. You could Google of Billy doing, you know, we could sit here for an hour just talking about Pipeline, you know, pretty much the most famous wave in the world, but we don't need to. Billy, my last question before Matt asks his last question, what does success mean to you?
There's so many different things.
Yeah, and you could answer it in any way, whether it's family, business.
No, it's such, you know, that word's been asked to me so much. And I think every chapter of life, it seems to change. Success at a young age was to be on the championship tour and to be sponsored and to live this dream of a professional surfer. And then it became like, you know, the success was just being able to surf for a living was being successful. Now, when you ask me what success, it's coming home at the end of every day and feeding everyone in my family.
Yeah.
Seeing my kids live under the same roof as their mother and father and in a healthy environment, seeing their mom and dad work together as a team, as a couple, and in love, you know, it's crazy, man. What a family will do to you is more testing and more challenging than anything in life, but at the same time is more rewarding. And that's what success is being able to raise a family under the same roof, happy and healthy. I mean, there's nothing more in life you can truly ask for.
Amazing. Well, go ahead.
Oh yeah. Okay. What's your favorite curse word, Billy?
My favorite curse word. Jesus Christ.
We asked everybody on this season what it is. So
yeah, it's like, you know, James Lipton.
Yeah.
You could ask my kids, and my kids are probably going to say, I say fuck too many times. Nice. Well, I'm very emotional for one. Yeah. I wear my heart on my sleeves. I'm an emotional man, and that's probably because of what I've went through and just not caging it, just letting it all fly. And I'm not quiet. And whether I'm training, whether I'm surfing, you're probably going to hear some loud,
I dig it,
curse words.
I love it.
Tall has like a little sheet of questions over here, and I'm like I always glance over at a sheet, and I'm hoping he asked it, but I just see Shane Dorian.
Right? Yeah, Shane, well,
I'm just gonna jump.
I mean, Billy looks up to a lot. Billy looks up to a lot of people, and Shane Dorian has been a massive supporter along with Laird. But maybe we could talk about Shane for a sec. I mean,
yeah, and both those guys, because both of them, absolutely, as growing up, both of them inspired me so much as surfers to basically be the best big wave surfers in the world. Laird coming from
the king,
like, you know, when you think of Aquaman, like,
right. Yeah, for sure.
Like, hey, Jason Momoa is a friend of mine. I love you, Jason, but fuck, you guys probably should have maybe used Laird because it would have been real.
Yeah.
And then you have Shane, who's just taken paddling big wave surfing to a whole new level. And both those guys inspired me so much in that aspect. But now, even more so, those two guys live up to the word father more than any other surfers who inspire me. It's truly beautiful to see where they're at with their careers and what they're doing and who they're doing them with. Shane's basically on like this worldwide tour of taking his son to go surf around the world. Amazing. Wherever he wants to surf. And majority of the time Shane's on the beach sitting behind a camera filming his son Jackson. And
so cool.
That's so cool to me. And it's so cool to share these stories with Shane and some of the trips with him and to hear how much he enjoys it. And yeah. Like, cause I always am like, are you worried about missing a jaws fall? And he's like, no, man, I'm really not. Because Shane's, I think, like 48 right now. I just turned 30. And I'm thinking about myself, like, do I have 15 more years, like, till I'm 45 of having this, like, selfish, like, mindset of just, I'm going to win jaws. I'm going to be there right. Every freaking swell for the next 15 years. Like, fuck, that's a lot of hard work. That's a lot of sacrificing. And, you know, they're in Laird with his chapter of really just taking health and wellness and training into an element that people wouldn't even believe is normal or possible. And I've spent a lot of time, and especially with Laird since this injury, I've spent more time with him than I ever have in my whole life. I've been living basically at their house for the last 3 months. And yeah, man, they inspire me so much on a family level that it's that's been a huge part of why I feel family is such a success to me is yeah. Off of what I've seen from them that's driven them and that's yeah. made them feel like they've succeeded. Their careers, whatever happens next is just a blessing, you know. Yeah. All the hard work has been yeah. done.
They're just trying to show people the way, you know, and I saw that when I was at Laird's with you, just like the people that were there, you know.
Yeah.
Just like, what? You know what I mean? Like exactly. You get to see way more, but yeah, it's amazing to watch you grow as an athlete as well, Billy. I couldn't tell you how proud I am of you. And, I know you're the comeback kid, yeah, you know, it's going to be awesome. And everyone's so proud of you. I'm proud of you. And I'm not lying when I say this was probably my favorite podcast that we've done yet. So
yeah, this is a good one.
Thank you. I appreciate it, you guys. And it's cool for me to be able to talk to you guys on a platform like this, because it's like, you know, it's not every day that you guys are going to be sitting in Vegas talking to
right.
surfers, but mm-hmm. there's people like, I'm really grateful and lucky for somebody like you, Tal, who is so well connected. I mean, you're friends with, you know, somebody like me and then somebody like Machine Gun Kelly. Right. Do me and Machine Gun Kelly have anything in common aside from we're both complete adredrenaline junkies?
Yeah.
No. Like, he comes from breaking guitars and being a rock yeah. star, where I come from riding big waves in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. So yeah. It's really unique that we can share friendship through each other and within each other. It's sick, and I'm very stoked to be on the show with you guys.
Yeah, man.
Fuck yeah.
Thank you so much, Billy.
Thanks, man.
Have fun doing what you're about to do with everyone out there. Yeah. Yeah. All right, yeah. Billy boy.
See you
later, man. Bud.
Love you guys. Have a good one.
Bye.
Hey, yo, bad news. Fuck going on.